Good evening and welcome to a very special edition of The Forum. On tonight's program, we bring you David Barsamian, host of Alternative Radio, heard every Wednesday morning at 9. Friends of Community Media brought David to Kansas City back on December 1st. He spoke at St. Garabed Armenian Church here in Kansas
Thank
City.
You for reminding me
the next voice you hear will be that of Bill Claus.
All congregation seating here, so get friendly with one another so that there's open seating at the ends, if you would, please. And we're getting ready to get started. I think there may be a few people still downstairs. We've lost the proclamation. Did you lose the proclamation?
Find it. It was on the chair right there. Why would anybody walk away?
Is he looking for these papers?
No, he's looking for the proc. It's a big folder thing that has the city proclamation in it. Okay, I know this is a church, but that doesn't mean you can still sit in the front row. Yeah. How you doing, man?
All right.
Hey, I want to get that. Can you put that on a flash?
I got it on this phone right here.
Okay, can you get that on a flash drive?
I have that one with me.
Oh, okay, but you can't. Can you?
Sure.
Okay,
sure,
yeah,
sure.
Do so. I was going to call you and do that. We're looking for a proclamation that has disappeared. Did you find it? Do what?
Tom.
Mr. Crane.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
Maybe you can ask if somebody picked up an envelope.
Okay, we are looking for a big folder that has a city proclamation in it that was on the back table there. That's kind of what the hold
there
up
it
is.
There it is. All right.
All right. So we will begin with Tom Crane coming up and reading said proclamation. That once was lost, but now is found.
How fitting it for a church.
Hi, I'm Tom Crane, and we're soon going to hear a great poem, and Bill's going to introduce everybody here. But today, the mayor signed a proclamation, and it says, recognizing alternative radio and KKFI. And it goes, whereas the media are vital instruments of preserving democracy in the United States, and they shape our views of our nation and the world, whereas an aggressive press helps foil corruption in our corporate and public lives, and David Barsamian has been in the forefront of speaking truth to power, both here and abroad, and whereas David Barsamian, his public affair program, Alternative Radio, it's been broadcasting on Kansas City Community Radio for over 10 years, and it's more than that, actually, and has been helpful in informing citizens on important matters. And whereas KKFI seeks to stimulate, educate, and entertain Kansas City's audience, to reflect the diversity of the local and world community and to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues, and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. And therefore, I, Sylvester James, Mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, on behalf of the citizens of this great city and the City Council, do hereby proclaim Alternative Radio and KKFI acclaim for the work that they have done to educate our citizenry, and hereby present this proclamation to David Barsamian as a token of our appreciation. Signed, thank you.
Okay, a couple of housekeeping things first. I was told by Alice Kitchen up here on the front row that she has petitions to sign for minimum wage, for Clean Missouri, and for
Health and Safety Kansas City, Missouri.
You can find about all of that. She'll be taking your signatures for that if you haven't signed it yet. Okay, also I was to announce that there will be a discussion group discussing the book Global Discontents, Conversations on the Rising Threats to Democracy, which is the book, of course, that we're all here to honor with our guest tonight. That will be at KKFI next Saturday from 10 until noon if you want to come and join that discussion group. And if you want to buy one of those books, I'm sure that David will be happy to provide that for you.
And that's 8 days from now. It's not tomorrow. It's 8 days from now.
Yeah. For those of you that thought December 8th was tomorrow, it's not. thank you all very much for showing up. Although we're kind of joined at the hip with KKFI, this is actually a Friends of Community Media event, and we appreciate all of you turning out and supporting that organization. You know, there's been a lot of talk since this new administration about the resistance, you know, and there's been a growing resistance movement, and I think that's very cool. But there have been those like our guests who've been part of that resistance way back before resistance was even cool to talk about. David Barsamian is certainly one of those. Alternative radio has been around since 1986, and it has covered all the issues that are near and dear to hearts of the people in this room. And I'm going to introduce David now. He is one of America's most tireless and wide-ranging journalists, integral part of the independent media landscape, both with his weekly radio show, Alternative Radio, in his 32nd year, and with his books with, and I'm going to murder some of these names.
Joseph Dolan first?
Oh, yes. Somebody forgot to remind me of that. So before I introduce, I will stop in mid-sentence and introduce Joseph, who somebody forgot to tell me that Joseph was going to come up and speak. I'm sorry. That's Joseph! Okay. Big hand for Joseph!
It's an honor to be here. I, like most of you, have been enlightened, educated, and illuminated by Mr. Barsamian's work. I was chatting with him briefly, especially about the work of the late, great Edward Said, partially because of his beautiful prose and his work, Orientalism. And through the years, I've tried to keep up with it when I can. This particular poem, you may have heard some of my poetry on KKFI. I think Soft Boyish Hands is one, and John Wayne in the Ghetto. This is the title poem of a chapbook that Prospero's Books will be producing sometime for me in the new year. This is called Black Lives Matter, and this particular reading I dedicate to Mr. Barsamian. If you've heard it before, thank you for listening again. This is dedicated to the church I go to, All Souls Unitarian. And I wrote it June 13th, 1915. Our first Black Lives Matter banner was stolen. And if you go to All Souls Now, as we find that it is in a very safe place. Anyway, this is the poem that I wrote to dedicate that first banner, Black Lives Matter. Black lives matter, yet the very air we breathe, this wondrous flesh we inhabit, our ever-resilient presence in this vast, recalcitrant land grab called America is casus belli. Black lives matter and have mattered since the Middle Passage. The cruel efficiency of slave patrols, whips, and pistols, along with the salubrious pleasures of coon hunts and lynchings after church. American power, with its oligarchs and hegemons, has always known Black Lives Matter when exercising their allegedly God-given right to terrorize through myriad blunt traumas, poll taxes, redlining, or that catchy buzzword, austerity. So-called liberals will slogan up the rallying cry, speak truth to power. Those in power already know Black lives matter, especially when the time comes for manufacturing Untermenschen before exterminating them in massacres for being uppity. From Roger Taney to Ronald Reagan, from Rush Limbaugh to Charles Koch and Prescott Bush, these acolytes of the pathology that is white supremacy know all too well Black lives matter in a most profitable, if savage, way. Because if Black lives did not matter, all these mechanisms, structures, and policies would implode. The fleeting comforts and elegancies accompanying white privilege would explode into a billion shards of shrapnel, leaving no white people at all, just people. From Darren Wilson to Bull Connor, from Woodrow Wilson praising Birth of a Nation to the bloviating flatulence of Fox News, Black lives matter as a fetish, much like a tar baby. Why do you keep wishing to be in the land of cotton when you are already here? From sea to shining sea, this is your country to run amok in. This is your country where you kept severed limbs and testicles as tchotchkes, much like your plundering brethren did with pyramids and other indigenous artifacts you hoarded into museums as gaudy testaments to your supposed civility. This is your country. You brutalize, then rationalize the atrocity of being in fear for your lives without so much as a scratch on you, while a black young man's corpse burns for 4 hours in the midsummer sun. Elegant courtier of manifest destiny that he was, you really shouldn't have listened to Rudyard Kipling. Do not blackmail us now with that sallow, surly notion of reparation. It will not absolve you in this, your beloved country of Eurocentric memory and Aryan promise, where beneath the twinned alabaster avarice of white supremacy and privilege lurks a death urge so abysmally psychotic and addictive, even Edgar Allan Poe couldn't stay sober enough to grasp its depth, its breadth, its menacing metamorphoses. This is your country where Black lives matter even more, because this is not an indispensable nation. You are not a chosen people. You are not a royal priesthood. How can a nation that gorged itself on genocide and slavery ever be? Brothers and sisters of the African diaspora, we know Black lives matter by our refusal, in our resistance, by our rebellions, and in our revolt. With the imminent threat of police gunning us down one by one, we summon the collective resilience of those who steadfastly and miraculously kept chasing the long arc of justice in the universe to challenge and rise up against 400 years of terror by fiat, of genocide for the literal and existential hell of it and profit of it. We will tear down the master's house. It is the only human and humane thing to do. It doesn't matter what plowshares or swords we use. We will take to the streets. We will riot if we must. We will tear down the master's house and subvert any ideology that presumes the master to have such a dubious title in the first place. We seek only justice, not revenge. For it is then, and only then, that the enslaved master will learn Black Lives Matter. They always have. They always will. Thank you.
Thank you for reminding me of that. We certainly would have been poor for missing that. Great, great poem, dude. Okay, at KKFI, we're very proud of the fact that we've been doing progressive programming on our public affairs shows clear back to 1988. Well, it turns out that we're kind of following the lead of our speaker tonight, who actually started alternative radio back in 1986. Been going on for 32 years, and it's kind of a who's who of people in the movements and people that we've all heard of and learned to appreciate. His books with Noam Chomsky, Iqbal Ahmad, Howard Zinn, Tariq Ali, Arundhati Roy, and Richard Wolff, and has been fighting the good fight for many years now. So a big hand for David Barsamian.
Well, good evening, Kansas City. Woo! It's great to be here. I bring you greetings from Boulder, Colorado. Yesterday I was in Kansas for the first time, incidentally. I've been traveling to Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Egypt, but had never been to Kansas. So it was, I won't make any jokes about Dorothy or Toto. I'm sure you're bored to death with hearing them, nor will I refer to the Kansas City Chiefs and Alex Smith and the kind of season they're having. Well, let me get a little bit comfortable here. It's so great to be here and support a wonderful community organization like Friends of Community Media and KKFI, one of the best community radio stations in the country. Now, I travel all over the United States. Now, you should know, and you probably do, if you go to Boston or Philadelphia or Baltimore or Miami, you know, these like liberal hotbeds of Marxist-Leninist thought, you know what? They would give their eye teeth to have a community radio station of the quality of KKFI. Not one of those cities has a community radio station. You think of Boston. Oh, you know, Noam Chomsky's lived there for so many years and Howard Zinn and all these progressives. Nada. They have wall-to-wall NPR with their endless programming of Some Things Considered, as I call it, and Morning Edition, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. But, you know, we listen to NPR, right, because we like to hear English spoken. We like to hear adverbs used properly. There's no yelling. But, you know, a lot of it, as Joseph mentioned in his brilliant poem, is bloviating flatulence. In other words, hot air, just gas emanating from these very pretentious and very self-important anchors and pundits and experts who give you, arguably, a range of opinion, no doubt about that. But it's from A to B. It's not from A to Z. So you get discussions about, well, what should we do about North Korea? What should we do about Iran? Should we bomb them now? And then you have an opposing voice saying, no, not now. Let's wait a few months. Let's put more sanctions on them, you know, create more international difficulties for them. You know, no one is talking about, hey, you know what? For those of you old enough to remember the Korean War, 1950 to 1953, there has never been a peace treaty signed. We have technically been at war with North Korea since 1953. That would be a great way to start, you know, a peace negotiations. Sit down. You know, I hate to quote Winston Churchill, who's the subject yet of another, you know, very admiring film that just came out. But he did say, it's better to jaw-jaw than to war-war. And war in Northeast Asia would be catastrophic. In fact, this is the topic of next week's alternative radio program with Eric Sirotkin on war or peace in Korea. There will be countless deaths in the millions. Seoul, which is the capital of South Korea, is right near the 38th parallel, the DMZ separating North and South Korea. So any attack on North Korea will result in enormous casualties. It's unthinkable, actually, that it's part of the discourse, because we're talking about annihilation. Not, you know, not like a little war going on here and there. Two schoolboys in a schoolyard taunting back and forth, yelling insults, you're little, you're big, you're puny, you're this, you're that. These are the leaders of these countries. And today, in many respects, is one of the darkest days in U.S. history, in a series of dark days. I say that because it looks like McCain and Jeff Flake of Arizona, both of them are from Arizona, Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, and what other senator just caved in? Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. They're all going to agree to pass what is arguably, I don't think unambiguously, one of the greatest transfers of wealth from the poor and the middle class to the upper class, to the 1%. And when the president, I won't mention his name, I'll call him throughout this talk exalted leader or the great leader, you know, like the way they talk about Kim Jong-un in North Korea, he said it's going to cost him a fortune, this particular tax bill. Well, actually, a conservative institute just came out with a report showing that he and the class that he represents are going to benefit hugely from this tax cut. Now, when you hear, you know, tax cut, tax reform, you feel kind of good, right? Reform, we're all for that, right? Education reform, health reform, it means something good. But this is how the language is perverted. In this case, reform means taking money, you know, from your pocket and putting it in the pockets of the billionaires, the Sheldon Adelsons, the Koch brothers, the Rebecca and Robert Mercer and Steven Schwarzman and all these other hedge fund operators that control billions and billions of dollars. Right now, three Americans, that is to say Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and Jeff Bezos, have more wealth than 50% of our population. We have 320 million people in this country. Three people have more wealth than 160 million people. Now, is this good for democracy? Is this the kind of economic future that the much venerated and, I must say, overrated founding finaglers or founding fathers, that's a Michael Parenti joke, thank you, Michael, the founding fathers envisioned? Of course not. They saw a more equitable a society built around equality, although they had real problems in their own lives with equality, being slave owners and white males who had enormous privilege. You know, it's very easy to criticize the great leader, but I am grateful for one thing. I must say, for years I've been talking about misogyny and white supremacy and patriarchy, and I would see like a blank look in people's faces, and I would have to explain what that is. But this error has unleashed a tsunami of misogyny, has enabling racism. Did you see what happened in Charlottesville? Could you have imagined at the end of 1945, when the United States had finally defeated the forces of fascism, that fascist groups would be marching in the streets of the United States with torchlights and saying, "We will not, Jews will not replace us," and Heil Trump? Could you, you can't imagine that. And after that event, what did the great leaders say? They have, they're good people on, they're fine people. So instead of condemning racist and anti-Semites, and that's who they were chanting a well-known Nazi slogan, blood and soil, Blut und Boden, and, you know, conjuring up those images. So this is a very, you know, I don't want to soft pedal this and, you know, kind of make you feel warm and fuzzy and cozy, because you shouldn't be. I think this is an extremely dangerous moment in the history of the United States when these forces have been enabled, the forces of racism, the forces of misogyny and white supremacy. So unfortunately, thanks to the great leader, I don't have to explain what misogyny means, or white supremacy, or patriarchy, because it is so evident now to people. And yesterday I was talking at KU in Lawrence, and there you could see, you know, the young people in that class who are the future of the country, the future media workers, the future journalists, and the kind of impact this kind of racist diatribes are having on them, particularly on people of color who are being singled out once again for lexical violence. That's the first step of genocide. That's the first step of killing someone. And how do I know that? I know it from my family. We are in Surp Garabed, that's to say Saint Garabed, Armenian church. I happen to be of Armenian background. My parents went through the first genocide of the 20th century in 1915. In my mother's family, there were 25. Just a couple of people survived. The rest, three of my four grandparents were killed by the Turks. But you know what the first stage of the genocide was? Lexical violence. The Armenians are scum. The Armenians are traitors. The Armenians can't be trusted. The Armenians are controlled by outside forces like Russia and France and England. So that was the first step in what became the first genocide of the 20th century. My mother finally did escape, got to Beirut, married my father there in 1921, and then they came to New York. And that was a huge influence on my background and shaping my view of the world, because I wanted to know, why did this happen? And so I became very politicized and very much interested in history. And I would ask the Armenian elders that had survived the genocide in New York. I was growing up in the 1950s. Well, you know, what happened? Why did the Turks, you know, turn on the Armenians? They had been living there for millennia in the land of Mount Ararat. And quite frankly, because this particular group was uneducated, they were farmers, they lived in rural areas, they didn't have access to schools and the like, they kind of lapsed into, well, the Turks hated us, they're bad people. They were very unsatisfactory answers. And so that, in me, just stimulated a desire to know, why do things happen? What are the forces at work that produce outcomes like genocide? A genocide, incidentally, in this case, which Adolf Hitler intimately knew about. His closest confidant was a German vice consul in Erzurum, in what is now eastern Turkey, part of historical Armenia. He came back to Germany after the war and told Hitler, you know, this is what the Turks did to the Armenians, and nothing happened to them. They got a free pass from the international community. You know, there was no justice. And Hitler was very impressed by what the Turks did. He was also very impressed by what the United States did to its indigenous population here. He was greatly admiring of the reservation system. You know, you wipe out large sections of the population, and then whoever is left, you stick them in inhospitable, hardscrabble lands and let them try and, you know, make a living for themselves. So Hitler said on the eve of launching his attack on Poland, when he was addressing German generals in the Wolf's Lair in the Berchtesgaden in the Alps, he said, "Don't worry, no mercy, and who remembers the annihilation of the Armenians?" So that was very much in his mind, that, you know, one people got away with the mass murder of another people, and it stimulated him to carry out the Holocaust and other, of course, mass murders of gays and lesbians and communists and socialists. And that reminds me, speaking of Germany, do you all know about Pastor Martin Niemöller? Quite a historic figure. You should be familiar with him, Niemöller. He served in World War I on a U-boat. He won the Iron Cross. After World War I, he was transformed by that experience and became a pacifist, and he became a Lutheran minister. And he is he became part of the anti-Nazi resistance. He was in Dachau concentration camp from 1938 to 1945. But during the resistance, he created this famous poem. You might be familiar with it. It starts off with, "First they came for." And I'm going to change that a little bit to update it. So, "First they came for the Muslims." And I didn't say anything. I didn't speak up. Hey, I wasn't a Muslim. You know, that's their problem. "Then they came for gays, lesbians, transgenders, queers." Well, I wasn't one of them. I didn't say anything. "Then they came for the trade unionists, union organizers." Well, I wasn't a member of a union. I didn't say anything. "Then they came for the communists and the socialists." Well, I wasn't one of them. I didn't speak up. "Then they came for the Jews." Well, I wasn't Jewish. I didn't say anything. "And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak up." So this is a moment now, I think, that Pastor Niemöller echoes. His words echo today with a sense of urgency, where there is more than a whiff of fascism in the air. I know that's a very loaded term. I don't want to use it promiscuously, as it is sometimes invoked. But I think we should, you know, use words carefully, and there is a definite whiff of fascism in the air, the merging of corporate and state power. And people, of course, are going to ask me, what can I do in this situation? That's the wrong question. The question has to be, what can we do? It's only through solidarity, it's only through collective action that movements grow and expand. You as an individual, however talented you may be, however well-meaning you might be, you won't be able to do much. You know, maybe you'll be able to write a clever editorial or give a talk somewhere. But ultimately, it's going to be about collective action moving forward. And, you know, again, KKFI is your electronic umbilical cord. Yeah. That's what brings you all together. That's why you're here this evening. So don't be hesitant about, you know, supporting the station and thinking creatively outside the box in terms of new ways of resistance. And as I said, it's one of the darkest days in the history of the United States. It's also one of the brightest days because General Michael Flynn has, pled guilty and will be sentenced for lying to the FBI. And I think this is now the fourth member of the regime, I use that term, the regime in Washington's staff that has been indicted, and I think more will follow. So we still have remnants of the rule of law in this country. But as we've seen, when other states have descended into fascism, it is law that is compromised. And we're looking and seeing For example, the great leader denouncing judicial opinions, singling out judges, humiliating them in public, singling out the media, my profession, as the enemy of the American people. Who is the enemy of the American people? The fraudulent occupant of the Oval Office, or people like David Barsamian or Matt Taibbi or Noam Chomsky or Glenn Greenwald or Jeremy Scahill or the people that are fighting for justice? Which side are you on? That was an old Union song from the 1930s, you know, in the Kentucky coal mines. Are you with the Union? Are you with the Union breaker, the owner of the mines, or are you with the workers? So, you know, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say down in Haines County there are no neutrals there. You're either for the Union or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? So J.H. Blair was the head of the company in Haines County in Kentucky. And so this song was sung when there was real solidarity in this country with working people in the 20s and 30s, when there was an active union movement. And that, of course, capital had to crush that. Capital had to move against unions, defang them, make it more and more difficult to organize, to a point where today, from a peak of 35 to 40%, we only have about 8, 9, or 10% of our working force organized. So you might think, well, that's a good thing. You know, I'm not paying union dues. I don't have to go to boring meetings. I don't have to read emails. That's just where the bosses want you. They want you isolated. They want you atomized. They want you separated, not to come together and to act, because then you're a powerful force. Hey, you're just one guy. Hey, Michael, that's just Michael. That's his opinion. He doesn't like the way I run my company. Tough luck. Find another job. I got 18 underage, you know, Central American refugees that are willing to work for less than union wage, less than the minimum wage. So there's so much work to be done. And by the way, this book is, there are only 4 copies left, but I'm really glad to know that there's going to be a book discussion around this. So if you don't get a copy, one of the 4 left, I'm going back to Boulder tomorrow. I'll mail it to you. You'll have it by the middle of next week, I promise. And I hate to give this little commercial break here, but I have to. The real bargain for you tonight are 4 new alternative radio programs for $20. If you ordered them from Boulder, it would be $75. Nancy McLean on the origins of right-wing populism. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, a Native American historian from genocide to resistance. Henry Giroux, who's absolutely brilliant. He's from Canada. Orwell, Huxley, and a New Authoritarianism. And Richard Wolff, Capitalism versus Socialism. So I hope you pick these CDs and books up. Make copies of the CDs. Spread them around. Get the word out there. Support independent media. Now, I bet there are a few people out there, just a few, old enough to remember a class that used to be taught. It's called penmanship. No, you don't remember. Well, okay, 1 person. 2. Okay, 3. 3. It was the art of writing clearly. Now, why do I make a silly joke like this? Well, everywhere I go, I hand out a sign-up sheet so I can keep in touch with you about alternative radio. And when I get back to Boulder, I can't read 3/4 of the names because they're scribbled. So if you'd kindly just give me your name and email and write clearly, I'd be most appreciative. Maybe we could start over here. And don't worry, I'm not going to share this with the FBI or the NSA, because they already have all your information. It's all locked up in a billion-dollar building in Utah, by the way, for which we have paid for, where all our information is stored about emails and personal phone calls and the like. One of the things I learned from Howard Zinn, our wonderful radical historian who is a dear friend and mentor, was to use humor, use history, to use humor in presentations. And you know, the left can get really boring and didactic sometimes. Hey, comrades, the end is near. It's worse than you think. Whoa, that must be just uplifting for young people to hear, you know, like, don't bother, it's all over, the game's, you know, it's we're toast. But I think it's important to, you know, inject humor. And along those lines, I invented a character a few years ago. You may have heard of him. His name is Dick Vanier. Dick is an extraordinary journalist, award-winning, of course. And we're going to do a little skit based on Dick Vanier. Dun, 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 dun. We interrupt this program from St. Garabed Armenian Church in Kansas City, Missouri, to bring you this breaking news story from TIBC, the Truth in Broadcasting Corporation, from our world corporate headquarters in our secure state-of-the-artless underground studios in Roswell, New Mexico. I'm Dick Vanier, your glib and banal anchor of Facade News. Facade News, the 24/7 newscast dedicated to keeping you in the dark. We go straight to the surface of a story and we stay there. No one can challenge our award-winning In Shallow reporting. We're dedicated to the highest standards of journalism. We make things up as we go along, unencumbered by elitist concepts like the truth. Our award-losing reporters are dedicated to giving you fake news all the time with a thorough and scrupulous disregard for facts. Our credos, unfair and unbalanced. We deceive, you believe. Ladies and gentlemen, an amazing story coming across our news desk at this very moment. Our exalted leader, whose name I cannot even utter, has determined that 2 and 2 is 5. He told Facade News in an exclusive interview that after much soul-searching and, of course, consultations with his daughter and son-in-law, that he now concludes that long-held views that 2 and 2 is 4 are wrong. He described the process while teeing off on the 13th hole of his Bedminster, New Jersey golf course. He said it was amazing and unbelievable discovery, and he added, "People love the tremendous math work we are doing." The great leader then added, "I give myself a 10. Stay tuned for updates on this and other breaking news stories on the Facade News Network. I'm Dick Vanier, your still glib and banal anchor. And now back to St. Garabed Armenian Church in Kansas City for your regularly scheduled broadcast. Well, I'm glad some of you laughed. You know, I gave this little skit to an audience. Where was it? Worcester State University in Worcester, Mass. This is in September. And everyone took it seriously. I mean, when the great leader said 2 and 2 is 5, they thought it was plausible. It's probably what happened today. You know, the sun is rising in the west and setting in the east. Haven't you heard? The great leader has spoken. So, you know, that made me really put me on edge. My God, these people aren't laughing. They were taking, that's how I think in some ways how deeply wounded we are as a people right now because of what's been happening and is happening in Washington. Now, there's a wonderful Canadian singer, musician, Leonard Cohen, who, let's hear it for Leonard. You should all be familiar with him. He passed away last year. He has a great song called "Democracy's Coming to the USA." You know, it's kind of with a question mark. You know, it's not a slam dunk. It might be coming or it might not be coming. It depends on what we do to a great extent. But he also has a wonderful song called "Anthem." And in this song, he writes, "Ring the bells that can still ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." So I've interpreted that without Leonard's permission as a way for the left to overcome sectarianism and to overcome difference and to find common ground. There's a crack in everything that we can get into and light a lighter light, a brighter light. And too often, people in progressive organizations or left groups, whatever you want to call them, are caught up in arcane and obscure and self-destructive and self-defeating arguments. You know, ooh, I can't talk to him. He supported Trotsky. Oh, that guy, he was an apologist for Stalin. Oh, this guy was a union man, and then he quit his union job, and I can't talk to him. You know, it's like that Pastor Niemöller. Pretty soon, there's nobody left. Oh, he voted, you know, she voted for Clinton. Oh, I can't vote. I can't do anything with him. I won't involve myself. How could I possibly support someone that, you know, voted for Clinton? We've got to overcome this sectarianism. It only weakens us. In fact, it's music to the people with power. You know, they are sowing these seeds of discourse. Yeah, you are different. You shouldn't be talking to these people. They're against you. You know, you've got enemies everywhere. Trust me, the boss. You know, trust me, the CEO of, you know, a Fortune 500 company. Trust me, the head of a Forbes 400 company. So overcoming that is really, really important. And I talked about the huge spike in inequality, which has had very deleterious effects on the lives of millions of people across the country, as we have now exceeded way beyond the Gilded Age of the 1890s, when, you know, I was growing up and reading history books in the 1950s. You know, it was about Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie and Jay Gould and all these guys that were amassing, you know, huge amounts of wealth. They're pikers compared to the guys who are around today, you know, who have this enormous amount of wealth. And what are they doing with that wealth? Well, they're saturating the political system with cash, with money. This has, of course, accelerated since the infamous Supreme Court decision of January 2010, Citizens United, which has literally taken the hinges off the door in terms of big money in politics, and the money is now secret. We don't even know where it's coming from. It doesn't have to be revealed. A huge blow against democracy. And it was Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, who was appointed by FDR, who said, we can have democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentration in the hands of a few. We can't have both. And that's why you're seeing democracy under attack right now, in a very parlous condition. Sometimes I say, you know, democracy is in the ER. You know, there's still a pulse, there's still breath, but it's in very weak conditions and shows signs of further weakening if these kinds of tax bills are passed and go into effect. What is it like to have a head of state who perpetually, pathologically lies to its population? I don't know the answer to that question. I'm just putting that out there. We have in the White House a serial prevaricator, a serial liar. There is no other, there's no ways to, David, oh, that's too harsh. You know, he's after all the president of the United States. 62 million Americans voted for him. He must be doing something right. You have to call a spade a spade. And you have to call a fascist, an oligarch. You cannot mince words when this is what is required. Right. So we have, right now, we are facing, I think, the greatest crisis in modern times. The threat, of course, of nuclear war, and the long-term threat of climate change, which this government denies, calls it a Chinese hoax, a hoax invented by the Chinese, has staffed people in the very agency that is dedicated to protecting the environment with climate deniers. I mean, it's hard to make this stuff up. I mean, Scott Pruitt from Oklahoma, the Attorney General of Oklahoma, what were his credentials? He sued the EPA 14 times when he was Attorney General of Oklahoma. On whose behalf? on behalf of the oil, petrochemical, fracking industry. In fact, one of the lawsuits on behalf of Devon Energy in Oklahoma was verbatim from a press release written by Devon Energy. I mean, this guy didn't even come up with his own original, you know, vocabulary. He just cut and paste and, you know, sent it off to the Justice Department. There's the assistant administrator of the EPA. It's a woman named Kathleen Harnett. I forget her last name. Does anyone remember? Anyway, an avowed climate denier who also says that carbon monoxide is not a deadly gas. Well, I invite her to turn on her engine, roll up the windows, and, you know, keep the car running and see whether carbon monoxide is deadly or not. And she also is a major climate denier. She denies that, you know, CO2 pumping into the air contributes to acceleration of greenhouse gases, which contributes to the warming of the Earth's temperature. These signs are so unmistakable, you have to wonder about the sanity of some of these people. But it's not enough to say, well, they're just crazy. They are crazy and they are not crazy. They are operating on behalf of a class that is dedicated to one thing and one thing only, and that's to making money. It's all about profits. It's all about today's net gain. In fact, this tax bill, you know, Gary Cohn, Goldman Sachs, remember, drain the swamp, that's all a whole bunch of rubbish. The swamp is deeper than ever. You know, the leader has brought in hedge fund, you know, managers and Goldman Sachs executives by the dozens to person different administration positions. Gary Cohn is the head of the Council on Economic Advisors. He recently admitted that there's one group that's really excited about the tax bill. Who are they? The CEOs. Well, then he went to Wall Street, and then he asked the CEOs, let's say a gathering like this, how many of you are planning to invest in your company and to create new jobs? Barely any hands went up. And Cohn was taken aback. He says, well, what are you going to do with this money? We're about to hand you, you know, an S-load of cash. And they answered, we're going to return it into dividends for our shareholders and give ourselves bigger and better bonuses. So that's going to be the outcome of this tax result. By the way, I guess I would say probably 4/5 of you came here tonight on your private jet. I knew I flew in from Boulder on my private jet. You know, it's one way to get around the TSA and lines and you know, secondary searches, which I'm frequently subjected to, particularly since I went to Iran last year. And if you have a private jet, you will get a special tax write-off. So I'm sure you're happy about that. And let those schmucks, you know, drive their cars and bicycles and be on public buses and what little mass transit we have in our cities left. So this is a moment, I think, that demands engagement. It demands enormous creativity, thinking outside the box, as people in Canada are doing, fighting pipelines, particularly in British Columbia, where Indigenous people, and they're called First Nations there, have organized and are promising to blockade any projected pipeline that might go from the Alberta tar sands out through mostly First Nations Indigenous land in British Columbia. They're building all kinds of blockades that's going on there right now. And let me talk a little bit about what happened at Standing Rock. Yes, it was a defeat. We knew the great leader was going to act favorably on behalf of the big oil and petrochemical companies. Nevertheless, 200 Indigenous nations, I don't call them tribes because that's a colonial word and expression, 200 nations, they have their own language, they have their own cultures, organized and got together for the first time at Standing Rock in years and years, because, you know, this is a deeply damaged community thanks to the European settlers who, you know, wreaked such enormous havoc on them, largely marginalized and brutalized and colonized, and so weakened enormously. They were able to come together along with their white and other people of color allies to mount a very impressive resistance at Standing Rock. And although, even though it didn't go through, there's still resistance there and a higher consciousness now among indigenous people. And the state of Nebraska has just rerouted the Keystone XL pipeline route, so it's not clear if TransCanada, which owns the pipeline and wants to build it out going through Nebraska, going near the Oglala, our huge aquifer there, out to the Gulf Coast. It may or may not happen. It will be, in the words of James Hansen, the foremost climate scientist that we have, the one who blew the whistle in 1988 in Congress, who warned the Congress there's something seriously happening. This is 1988. Something is seriously happening with the climate. There's evidence points to increasing presence of greenhouse gases with subsequent heating up of the Earth's temperature as well as the rise of the sea level. So he said it at that time, he said more recently, that if the tar sands, which are in northern Alberta, they are the filthiest carbon known to humankind. If those tar sands are released, he used the term game over for the climate. We may have some little cosmetic things we could do, which is, the great way liberal democratic capitalism operates. They give us little pieces of bread. They own the bakery. They own the sugar. They control the sugar, the milk, the eggs, the wheat, the rye and everything else, and we're given a few crumbs, and we're supposed to say, thank you, master, and kiss their hand like they're some demigods. Well, in this case, we're talking about the future of the planet, not something in 2120. We're talking about in the next 10 or 15 years. The words that are being used are unmistakable and unambiguous. Words like record-breaking, words like unprecedented, words like tipping point being invoked over and over again. And that's what we're looking at. So I used to talk to audiences and say, well, if you've got grandchildren, you should be really concerned about their future. You should be concerned about your future because it's right now. Climate change is upon us. And so I can't stress the importance of, working on this issue, delinking ourselves from the what I call fossil foolishness, and creating sustainable energy, which is not something abstract. China and Germany are leading the world in solar panels and using sustainable energy. And what does the great leader want to do? He wants to impose import tariffs on solar panels coming from outside the United States. We should be drinking tap water, by the way. One thing that I learned is never give these corporations a free ad, with their bottled water. That's another ripoff that corporations have, impressed people. Oh, you got to have bottled water. It's pure. It's pure. Tap water is just great, and we should be protecting it. But this goes back to, how the system operates. They're like, when I was growing up, one of my heroes was Sugar Ray Robinson. He was a middleweight boxing champion. I think he was from Jersey City, if I'm not mistaken, originally. Anyway, he was in New York. He's noted for his, 1-2 punch. He would dance. He was a forerunner of Muhammad Ali, let's say. He would dance in the ring. And that's what, kind of what the system does to disenable us. It gives us these little, as I mentioned, crumbs, ride your bike to work whenever you can. Buy a fuel-efficient car or a hybrid. Recycle your paper and your glass and your cardboard. Use compost, don't throw away your food. These are all good things, by the way. I do them myself. But, you know, it's kind of trying to put your finger in the ocean that's out there. And while you may feel good about doing these things, and I encourage you to do them, we shouldn't delude ourselves that this is it. This is the answer. I can just continue with, you know, the rest of my life. I'm doing my part. I recycle. I have a proper car and all, and I bike everywhere or walk. You know, it's much more than that that's required. So the weight on us, I hate to be so boring and use pedantic words like weight, but we have an enormous responsibility right now for the future. And one thing we learned from Native peoples is long-distance viewing, 7 generations. The capitalist economic system has a distance vision of about one day, maybe a little bit beyond that, but it is dedicated in its DNA to amassing more and more wealth. That's what it's about. Anyone who tells you anything different is pulling the wool over your eyes. I don't know what goes on in the economics department at KU or in St. Louis or any of your other, you know, state universities or colleges or private colleges and universities. But really existing capitalism in its DNA is about maximizing gain, no matter what. That is, so we cannot depend on this system to change the system. You're asking the fox to go into the hen house and to suddenly transform himself or herself into some benign creature that's going to protect the hens. It's not in the cards. We delude ourselves to think that capitalism is the answer. It has to come from collective action. Now, call that whatever you want. You know, I call it socialism. That's what Bernie Sanders calls it. You know, democratic socialism. Whatever it is, don't get hung up on words, because then we get into other, you know, lexical debates. What's needed is collective action, people coming together and saying basta, like people came together in Bolivia, in Cochabamba. Not a privileged population, for those of you who know Latin America and Bolivia. Very poor people. Overnight, their entire water system was sold to Bechtel. And overnight, the price of water quadrupled. And overnight, people came out in the streets and were screaming, basta, we, you know, el agua es nuestro. The water belongs to us, it is ours. It's not something to be sold to an American corporation or to any corporation. There was so much street pressure in Cochabamba that the government annulled the contract, and water again became part of the commons. There are examples and examples of that, of people like Rosa Parks refusing to sit down. She said, I was sick and tired of, I'll get you the exact quote, because it's a wonderful thing that she said about, ein Moment bitte. Well, I'm going to have to paraphrase. I'm sorry. I wasn't tired physically, or no more tired than I usually was at the end of a working day. No, the only tired I was tired of giving in. And throughout history, we've seen oppressed peoples, people who are disadvantaged, who are not privileged, and most of us, I dare say, are fairly privileged. You know, we're not worrying about where our next meal is coming from. We have a roof over our heads, I hope. So we don't have those kinds of life and death issues that if you are poor, it monopolizes you. It's all you think about. Where are you going to get food? Where am I going to sleep tonight? When I go to the AR office in Boulder, and I hope you come and visit me there sometime, I go through a public park. Every morning, people are coming out of the bushes, you know, and I see the sleeping bags and the blankets and the cardboard boxes. That's in Boulder, Colorado. It's one of the most privileged towns in the United States. I dare say you might have homeless people here in Kansas City, right? So, you know, there's a huge amount of wealth, but it's being siloed off to the precious 1% and the 1/10th of 1%. And activism, as the great Alice Walker, who wrote The Color is Purple and many other very important books, she said, activism is my rent for living on this planet. Activism is my rent for living on this planet. Right? And Martin Luther King Jr. said, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. The day we become those people that Pastor Niemöller talked about, that they came for them and I wasn't one of them. I looked away. Our lives begin to end then. We become diminished as human beings. We have lost the sense of community and sisterhood and brotherhood. A union slogan years ago was, an injury to one is an injury to all. You know what it is today because of corporate capitalism? An injury to one is an injury to one. You got injured? Tough luck, honey. You got injured? Tough luck. You're on your own. Figure it out for yourself. Work within the system, you know? So to revive that spirit of solidarity is also very important. Stephen Biko, who was a great liberator in South Africa, he was murdered by the South African police when he was held in custody by them. He said the most powerful tool in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. The most powerful tool in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. So to the extent that we are colonized, to the extent that we buy into this crap and into the lies and the propaganda, to that extent, we are collaborators and we are complicit with the system. So breaking away from those propagandistic tropes is also, again, part of that energy of reviving democracy. And, you know, I can think of no one better than Noam Chomsky, who practically invented the field of linguistics in terms of, you know, decoding language. You know, every time the United States, it never invades a country. It whenever it gets involved in another country, right? Have any of you seen the Ken Burns documentary on Vietnam? 18 hours, 10 parts, PBS. Ken Burns, an icon, brilliant editor, writer, you know, multi, I think he won 15 or 16 Emmys. You know, brilliant when he does things on jazz, on baseball, even on race. But when he does things about imperialism, like Vietnam, the war in Vietnam, and the war on Laos and Cambodia, he completely collapses. He doesn't have a clue because this is ideology. And ideology is freighted with loaded terms. So he begins the series by saying U.S. involvement in Vietnam. You remember involvement when you were in high school, you got involved with a boy or you got involved with a girl. So the U.S. got involved with Vietnam, and a series of tragic mistakes were made by decent men. How does he know they were decent? They were war criminals. Johnson, Kennedy, McNamara, Rusk, all of them should have been in Leavenworth serving time, just like their successors, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, and all the Wolfowitz, all of them should be in Leavenworth. And where are they? They're out writing their memoirs. They're out getting million-dollar contracts. They're out being interviewed on talk shows with great, you know, respect and veneration. You know, we just went through some war crimes trials in Bosnia, and Bosnian war criminals and Croatian war criminals. Yes, they should be brought to justice. What about our war criminals? What do we say to a younger generation that asks, where were you? Why wasn't something done about these people? So the U.S. never invades a country. It never attacks another country. It gets involved. So you'll never see the word, and Ken Burns, I haven't seen all 18 hours, the word aggression, U.S. imperialism, is never used in 18 hours. In fact, it's a defense. We defended South Vietnam. He doesn't even mention, I mean, the other wars, the other catastrophic wars in neighboring Cambodia and Laos, I mean, he does mention them, but those too were acts of aggression. And the media go along with this. So when Putin invades Crimea and annexes Crimea, it's called aggression. Exactly right. But when the U.S. invades the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, Panama, you name the country, close your eyes and, you know, do this kind of pin the tail on the donkey and put your hand on some part of the globe, it's most likely the U.S. either has invaded that country or has threatened that country with invasion or has a military base in that country. We are what Eisenhower's worst nightmare was, a military-industrial complex which prioritizes guns over butter. And you know, the liberals, and that was LBJ's, Lyndon Johnson, he was a president in the 1960s, that's what LBJ's big slogan was. Oh, we can have guns, we can have the war in Indochina, and we can have butter. Well, that, of course, completely collapsed. And we have less and less butter and more margarine and other artificial ingredients on our dinner table rather than a good old-fashioned butter. Nothing lasts for empire forever, and this empire is on its way down. And in some ways, that's a good thing for the rest of the world. It means less intervention. It means less war. It means fewer drone attacks, fewer American military bases. I mean, look what happened. How many of you knew the U.S. was militarily involved in Niger before the killing of these four soldiers? A handful of people. Why should you know? It's unreported. In fact, it is so routine that the U.S. has troops all over Northeast Africa, Central Africa, Northwest Africa, the Maghrib, throughout the Middle East, Southeast Asia. There's a vast archipelago of military bases all over the world, right? Costing us trillions of dollars. The war on terror, which started the day after September 11th, is now costing $5 trillion, according to a report just released by Brown University. $5 trillion, you know, that's not chump change. Do you remember Everett Dirksen? He was the GOP leader in the Senate in the 1950s. And he said, he used to make a joke, billion here, billion there. Pretty soon you're talking real money. Well, now it's in the trillions. And we're pissing away our wealth. We're pissing away the future of the country for our young people because of the military-industrial complex. There's no money for the environment. There's no money for healthcare. There's no money for education. There's no money to bail out students who are $1.3 trillion in debt. There's no money to repair the environment, to build more trails and to protect our parks and make sure that we have clean air and clean water. But there's plenty of money for Lockheed Martin. There's plenty of money for Boeing. And supposedly Mike Pompeo, who's the great leader's choice as a CIA director, is maybe the next Secretary of State. He is the representative from Boeing. That's what Wichita is, the most important economic force in that city. So you see all of these, you know, how the military-industrial complex just keeps marching along while we're left, you know, with the crumbs. And we're, you know, we're told there's no money for healthcare. Sorry, we'd love to, you know, spend a little bit more, but we've got to close this health clinic. There's no money for reproductive rights. We've got to close this, you know, branch of whatever government agency. So there's plenty of money. The issue is, when are we going to say basta, like the people in Cochabamba, like the people in Egypt who rose up against the Mubarak dictatorship that we backed till the very last moment? Time and time again, we've seen that, how things can change overnight. For example, you know, you remember the beginning of what was called the Arab Spring. When and where did it start? In December 2010, in a small village in southern Tunisia called Bouaziz, a fruit vendor was being shook down by a government officer, you know, who wanted a bribe and was hassling this guy. And then, you know, he was so angry about that, he went to the municipality, to the government offices, to seek redress, to seek justice. He says, you know, what is this? I'm trying to make a living. They didn't even give him the time of day. And he was so angry about that that he burned himself. He committed suicide. He burned himself, as the Buddhist monks did in 1963 in Saigon. That launched a revolution in Tunisia. Within 3 weeks, a 23-year-old entrenched U.S.-backed dictatorship of Ben Ali collapsed. No one in their right mind could have predicted this. No one. What? You mean a street vendor kills himself and the regime is going to topple? Never happened. They've got everything. They've got the police. They've got the army. They have the intelligence forces. The same thing in Egypt and in other countries where there was uprisings. So peoples in much dire conditions than we are in are able to organize and rise up and resist. And I think art is very important in struggle. I know struggle is a kind of boring word too, but it is what we are engaged in right now. It was the great revolutionary Emma Goldman who said that art has the power to make ideas felt. Art has the power to make ideas felt. So when we hear great poems like Joseph's, when we read Yeats's Second Coming, when we read W.H. Auden's September 1st, 1939, when we read Arundhati Roy's novel, The God of Small Things, or Sinclair Lewis' It Can't Happen Here, or George Orwell's 1984, or Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. If you want to understand imperialism, read that 100-page novella. That's all you have to know about imperialism. He goes into the Heart of Darkness and deciphers it. He decodes it. A very important book written, and he's talking about the Congo. Right now I'm reading a book written by Philip Roth, The Plot Against America. Philip Roth is a great American novelist. The premise is that in 1940, Charles Lindbergh, who was a crypto-fascist, ran against FDR and defeated him. And he became president. And we had a fascist state in the United States. In fact, to show you, to demonstrate once again, if you need further demonstration, how ill-informed and ignorant this junta is in Washington right now, I bring you to the term America First. What are its origins? Again, if you know a little history, it can be very dangerous. The origins of America First is fascism. Charles Lindbergh, a great American hero who flew across the Atlantic in 1927, the first solo flight, later got involved in a huge domestic scandal because one of his children or several of his children were kidnapped and killed. He became enamored with the Nazi regime, and he became the leader of a political party in the United States called America First. And in fact, he said this. He visited Germany before World War II broke out. It impressed him greatly. He was struck by what he called its organized vitality. Yeah, I guess stormtroopers marching in lockstep is organized vitality. I have never in my life been so conscious of such a directed force, Lindbergh said. It is thrilling to see the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. He warned against the U.S. being involved in World War II in a war against Germany. Why? Because we would lose our most priceless possession. What is that? Our inheritance of European blood. And then he gave a speech on September 11th, 1941, in Des Moines, Iowa, to a huge crowd, in which he denounced those who wanted the United States to get involved in World War II. And he said there were three groups that were pushing this: the British, the government, and the Jewish race. They are the greatest danger to this country because of their influence over our government and our media, he told the audience. So that's the origin of America First. And I went to some of these right-wing sites, of which there are many on the internet. You know, I don't want you to spend a lot of time going there, but the virulent anti-Jewish, racist, homophobic, misogynist poison and toxin that's coming out of those things is very, very disturbing. Again, I think that's been largely enabled by someone sitting in the Oval Office, you know, who calls neo-Nazis very fine people. One of the sites is called altright.com. Another one is called Tablet. It's interesting that how they describe Harvey Weinstein, the now discredited, outrageous, Hollywood producer who molested many, many women. They call him a fat Jewish perv. He has a special Jewy, J-E-W-Y, perverseness of Harvey Weinstein. It's a deeply Jewish kind of pervert, playing out his revenge fantasies on the goyim. Again, I think we should be concerned when this kind of toxin is released. And, you know, we saw that actions have consequences. Words have meaning. So when you get on one of these crazy internet sites and you read that Hillary Clinton is running a child pedophile ring under a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., the Comet Pizza Parlor actually exists, you pick up a gun in North Carolina. Guns, in case you don't know, are very easy to obtain here in our great country. You pick up a gun in North Carolina, and you go to Washington and take the law in your own hands. This is what is happening when you have this kind of poison out there and this kind of scapegoating. That's one of the major criterion of how fascists operate. They scapegoat people. Yeah, I'm with you, brother. I know you're working for minimum wage. You're working a weekend job. You don't have money to pay for your child care. You don't have money to take care of your aging parent who's dying or whatever. And you know why? Because of those people. Because of Mexican rapists, Mexican murderers, because of Muslims, because of Arabs, because of African Americans, because of other minorities, because of liberals who are now being included in that kind of grab bag of scapegoats. Very, very dangerous. And this, we see this poison spreading right before our eyes. And so are we going to be good Germans in 1945? Oh, I didn't know what happened to my neighbors. Yeah, I was kind of wondering, you know, they weren't there for 6 years and then they never came back. What happened to them? I didn't know. It was willful not knowing. They knew they didn't want to know simultaneously. You know, you can have, it's like doublethink. You can hold two contradictory ideas in your mind at the very same time. Read 1984. It's more relevant today than it ever was. And it is the number one book on Amazon. But don't get it through Amazon. Support your local independent bookstore. Go to Prospero's, and there's another one here in town.
Rainy Day.
Sorry?
Rainy Day.
Rainy Day. Support, yes, we said that. We support your independent bookstore. So, you know, going back to music and art, very important in terms of resistance because that, you know, fills out a lot of things that sometimes tired political arguments can grow weary with the fair. That's another line from Yeats, by the way. The heart grows weary from the fair because it has been fed on illusions for so long. So many illusions we've held about our country. Should we even say it's still our country or is it their country? The way it's going, it's the correct pronoun might be their,
yeah,
not our. And we have got to resist that. And we may not win, by the way.
Right.
I mean, let's not have illusions about the forces against us. They're very, very powerful. They're well organized and they're bankrolled. They've got capital. But I think in resistance, there is dignity.
Yeah.
And in resistance, there's self-respect. And, you know, and if, you know, there is a future generation, they ask, well, where were you, you know, when they came for the Muslims? Where were you when they came for the Arabs? Where were you when they came for the Jews? You say, I was there. I was fighting. I was part of the resistance. I said no. So it's very important to be part of that and to recover our humanity. What does power want? They want obedience. The problem in this country, as Howard Zinn used to say, is not civil disobedience, it's civil obedience. We need less obedience and more fight back, more resistance. That is the struggle that we are engaged in. And I've been talking a lot about poetry, and I've also been rereading a book that came out in the 1980s with written by Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death. Very, I think, very prescient understanding of what pop culture does to a people and a civilization. When a population becomes distracted by trivia, when cultural life is redefined as a perpetual round of entertainments, when serious public conversation becomes a form of baby talk, when, in short, a people become an audience and their public business a vaudeville act, then a nation finds itself at risk. Yeah. And we are at risk today. An unconscious people, an indoctrinated people, a people fed only on partisan information and opinion. So go to InfoWars, go to Red State, go to alt-right, go to these other right-wing sites and see what they're saying. Opinion that confirmed their own bias. A people made morbidly obese by junk food, by the junk food of propaganda. I love this line. A people made morbidly obese in mind and spirit by the junk food of propaganda is less inclined to put up a fight, to ask questions and be skeptical. That kind of an orthodoxy can kill a democracy.
Who's the author of this?
Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And that second quote about morbid junk food of propaganda, that's from Henri Giroux, Canadian professor. That CD is right over here. So, Alberto, how are we doing on time? You're doing okay? There's a few more things I want to say. I have so many things I want to talk to you about, but I want to talk to you a little bit about Antonio Gramsci, who's one of my heroes and someone who inspires me greatly. He was an anti-fascist. He was part of the resistance against Mussolini. He was born in Sardinia in 1891, and he died. He was in Mussolini jails from 1926 to 1937. He was never treated properly. He became more and more ill, and he ultimately succumbed to his illnesses. He was a newspaper editor, brilliant theorist, but he was also, as Edward Said called him, an organic intellectual, like Chomsky. He was connected to movements. He wasn't someone in an ivory tower writing, you know, important books that no one could understand, but that would be, you know, very positively reviewed in peer journals. He was, he gave movements their intellectual vitality and raison d'etre. Anyway, he wrote that when civilizations are in decline, and he was writing about fascist Italy, that's where fascism started, by the way, in 1915. Mussolini invented the first fascist party. It comes from a Latin word, fascisti, which is a bundle of woods of kindling wood. That was the symbol of the fascist party. He said, when a civilization is in decline, all kinds of morbid symptoms start appearing. And I would submit that the current occupant of the Oval Office is one such example of a morbid symptom, as is all kinds of magical thinking, chemtrails, pigs can fly, wild assertions made about on the internet about this or that science, challenging science, challenging the achievements of the Enlightenment. All of these morbid symptoms arise in a period of decline. And magical thinking, I have here like a few examples of that. I mean, Boulder, right? Very liberal, very progressive. That's where I live. You go into a coffee shop and you find, you know, endless announcements such as New World Consciousness Conference and Expo, featuring internationally renowned speakers that will raise your awareness. Join the new consciousness. Of course, for only thousands of dollars a weekend, you can become part of that. This is for an event in Denver. This is just one of many kinds of things that are out there. Denver Near-Death Studies. Open doors, open hearts, afterlife, contacts from beyond. Miss your mom? Want to get in touch? Now's your chance. Sign up for this weekend seminar, and we'll put you in touch with your dear and departed ones. It's just a check away. Do it now. This one I got in Madison, Wisconsin, where I was last month. It was on a kiosk, and my eyes just jumped on this one. Meditation Crash Course. I said, what? I looked twice. I mean, they're so antithetical. How can you have meditation and a crash course? Hear Buddhist teachings. Learn how to meditate. Meet Buddhists and see what they're like. Come. Diamond Way Buddhist Center in Madison. But this is my favorite because it's so modest. The greatest event in history is now unfolding. I mean, I was worried, you know, like these are just one of the greatest events, but this is the greatest event in history. Maitreya, the teacher for all humanity, is in the world. Join us for a free presentation about unfolding world events from this great teacher. Learn about the relationship between UFOs and the spiritual hierarchy of our planet. Exclamation point. Okay, and then they use a word here. Maybe someone knows this, can translate into English. Space bothers. Does anyone know what that means? I've asked around because they say, learn about the relationship between UFOs, the space bothers, and the spiritual hierarchy. I don't know. Anyway, so that's on one hand, okay? So you have a rise of magical thinking. But also, I want to begin and end with Gramsci. He also said, you have, when people ask him, well, what can you do? You're living in a Mussolini dungeon. You know, you're locked away for the rest of your life. You're dying from tuberculosis. You're toast, Antonio. Well, he said, you have pessimism of the intellect. That's what you see in front of you. Mussolini's the dictator. Italy's a fascist state. The fascists control all aspects and apparatuses of the government. Yet, he says, you have optimism of the will. So we have to have that willpower to overcome pessimism. And the great Uruguayan journalist and historian and a friend, Eduardo Galeano, who passed away a couple of years ago, he was asked this question. I get the same question all the time. You know, how do you keep your spirits up? You know, you're always, you know, talking about these horrible things and what's happening with income inequality and wealth inequality and racism and misogyny and patriarchy and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Eduardo said, I'll save despair and depression for better times. When we start winning, maybe I'll succumb and I'll indulge myself. But until we turn that corner, this is not a time to engage in any kind of wallowing in self-pity. So get away from the Drudge Report, from Breitbart News. Support KKFI, support alternative radio. Be independent, think outside the box. And I'm going to close. That's an applause line. Whew, it's about time. I mean, isn't there a game tonight? There's always a game. Oh, here's a current Time magazine cover, which apparently the Koch brothers are about to buy, or enabling Meredith Publishing in Iowa to close the deal. It's called The Wrecking Crew, How Trump's Cabinet is Dismantling Government, and particularly the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, Time is not exactly a leftist rag. You know? We're not talking about The Nation or The Progressive or In These Times. It's a very mainstream kind of journal, but it is raising the alarm as other people have raised the alarm because the signs are so transparent. When you have oligarchy and fascism facing you in the face, you have two choices. As Pastor Mueller said, you can look away. Hey, it's not my problem. That's your problem. Or you can engage. You can resist. And to think about, you know, I mentioned John McCain. Just a few days ago, he said we must fight against propaganda and crackpot conspiracy theories. That's John McCain, just a couple of days ago. And if we are to believe, he's now voting for this tax ripoff of the poor and the middle class. A direct assault on Medicare, by the way. And then someone else I like to quote, you know, just listen to what they are saying, the people on that side of the aisle. Bob Corker from that well-known radical state of Tennessee, you know, calling Trump, calling the great leader, I apologize, he's treating his office like a reality show. He's doing The Apprentice. He concerns me. He would have to concern anyone who cares about our nation. Corker, incidentally, is also voting for the tax giveaway for the rich. Well, they are benefiting from this. I mentioned W.H. Auden, great poet. He wrote a poem on the first day of World War II, September 1st, 1959. He was sitting in New York. I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth. All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. Yet, dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I compose like them of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. It's a great, great poem. It's also in this poem, by the way, he says, I can paraphrase it. I and the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. Think about that when your thoughts drift over to the never-ending war on terror, on the huge growth of groups all over the world now, from what started as a tiny criminal gang in the Afghan mountains, Al-Qaeda, to what has mushroomed into this archipelago of groups around the world, from all the way from Morocco, all the way to Pakistan, to Indonesia, and elsewhere. Is that at all connected to U.S. foreign policy? Can anyone even broach the subject without being called out as a traitor, someone who is disloyal? But there is a connection. We're kidding ourselves if we don't talk about the relationship of foreign policy and foreign policy outcomes that generate animosity toward the United States. I mean, if you were a Palestinian, how would you feel about your homeland being occupied? 800,000 olive trees have been cut down by the Israeli occupation. 50,000 Palestinian homes have been destroyed. This is the 50th year of the longest occupation in modern times, the Israeli occupation of Palestine. It continues. Why do I mention that? Because we enable it. We are the bankrollers. We protect Israel at the UN. We protect Israel at other international fora. We provide Israel with billions of dollars in aid. Have any of you been to Israel? It's a very wealthy country. It has a per capita income exceeding many members of the European Union, certainly Greece, Portugal, Spain, Romania, Poland, and other countries. Yet this aid continues, and no one will speak. It's a taboo subject. Silence around this. And to break that silence requires a good deal, I think, of courage. But I think it's morally incumbent upon us to talk about what is going on. What is going on in India? I didn't mention Myanmar, which is a horrific situation, because there isn't much leverage that the U.S. has. The U.S. is not giving vast amounts of economic or military aid to the Myanmar, the Burmese military junta. In fact, it has called it out as carrying out ethnic cleansing, which is exactly what it was. A euphemism for genocide, by the way. Let's call it what it is. when you target a population and make it impossible for them to live where they are, when you drive them from their lands and destroy their cultural institutions, as happened to the Armenians in 1915, to which the Turkish government to this day denies with great fervor, and as does the other deniers, the United States and Israel. There are three countries that deny the genocide of the Armenians. It's shocking, but that is true. Israel, the United States, and Turkey say it never happened. It was a war. It was a tragic situation. Bad things happened to people on both sides. So speaking out on those issues, all those military bases, all those drone attacks on Iraq, the attack on Iraq will go down in history as the beginning and the end of U.S. hegemony in the world. Some of you may applaud that. Some of you may think that's a good thing. It is a catastrophe that continues to unfold. It has proliferated violent groups of resistance, not just in Iraq, not just in neighboring Syria, but throughout the Islamic Middle East. And we are responsible for that. Many of us tried to prevent that war from starting. And the fact that these people are walking around scot-free is a shame on all of us. It is a shame on the justice system that they have not been held accountable. If you're some black kid in the ghetto and you walk out of a pizza parlor without paying, you're going to jail tonight, probably with no bail. If you drive away after you fill up your tank with gas and don't pay, you're probably going to jail for that. But if you invade a country, if you destroy a civilization and kill hundreds of thousands of people and wound many more hundreds of thousands, you're honored with book contracts. You're honored with lectures at the University of Kansas or whatever other major universities you have around here. That makes my blood boil. Ah, wow, you're full of passion. Yeah, I'm full of passion because I care about these things. And I wish more of us did. And that's the hope in the future. Because as Frederick Douglass said, without struggle, there is no progress. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom yet deprecate agitation are men and women who want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without its mighty waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. Thank you very much. Viva KKFI!
We're going to have a book signing, and we